Perimeter for the first time, shameful to admit. And I remember I heard about Perimeter for the first time in 2001 when Lee Smolin was visiting the Max Planck Institute in Gorm, and I was a postdoc there, and he was just about to come here. And it's impressive to see how far it has come in all these years. So anyway, I'm happy to be here, and I had this challenge to make. I learned in my youth that titles have to be short, and so I had to make a new word, come up with a new word in order to achieve that. And if it takes even Pedro a while to understand what that means, then I think it will take a while before that will work. So I will talk about a project that we, in fact, started about 5-6 years ago. And so there will be a part of a review and part of a sort of a sketch of new results. And so first of all, I have to tell you what this polyhedron is. That's a polygon that has been taken to a certain limit. The HE is supposed to remind you of high energy. And so a high energy polygon is one that has essentially, when you look from a distance, it just seems to have four cusps or corners. And only if you look very precisely into one corner, you see that there's many little corners there. And so now, like I think everybody here, because this is such a great place for scattering, knows, of course, that you're supposed to look at this polygon as a picture of a scattering, because this is sort of basically the gluon, like little momenta that you see here that have been put together into this polygon. And so what this means is that you have four really large momenta and then lots of small things. And so this is something that is actually realized in experiments. When you think of LHC, you collide like particles with LHC with very, very large momentum. And sort of the most interesting corner of this scattering is basically when you have these two particles collide, and they will, I mean, the main things will kind of fly through, will get slightly deflected, and lots of garbage comes out at much lower momentum. So this is the regime that we are looking at. Okay, so that motivates these polyhedrons, these things where a lot of garbage. So this is all this little stuff that comes out and transfers momentum that you can see in the collider. The large things, of course, you never see because they go more or less in the beam direction. Now, when we started this a few years ago, I think it was a main motivation for us was to kind of help string theory attack its childhood trauma, which was, of course, as you know, that string theory was super successful in the beginning, explaining all these hadronic resonances. But then when it came to high energy scattering, when you go to large center of mass momentum S, energy S, then you know, I mean, the Veneziano formula falls off exponentially, and this is way too fast for what you see in the lab. And of course, we understand why that is, because that's sort of the scattering region is very fuzzy. And so in energy space, the amplitudes fall off too quickly. Of course, we know now that how to correct for this. The problem was only that they, in the old days, they had strings in the same space as the particles. And so we understand very well that, of course, the strings have to live in ADS, and the redshift in ADS is sort of what makes it all work. So there is regions where you can have particle-like features, high energy scattering, and then also low energy behavior, as you see it in standard hadronic physics. But this is a qualitative picture, okay? So this explains you how ADS does it, but the question is, can you actually use it for computation? Can you actually use string theory to get precision results for high energy scattering in this large S regime? And so this is what we started off 5-6 years ago. Now I can tell you about the plan. So this will, this audience probably is a little difficult because much of, central pieces of the story I'm going to tell you have been developed here. So I don't know how well you communicated in your group. I mean, I sometimes learn about my colleagues' works from traveling somewhere else and talking to random other people. So I'll start off with a review. All this, Shota said in the beginning, is of course a story that is told in N equals 4 super young mills, which is the theory where the precision computations, of course, have advanced the most. So N equals 4 super young mills, as you probably all know, is a little bit special. It has more symmetry than a expected, not just conformal symmetry, but also this dual conformal symmetry, which means that the scattering amplitudes, there's basically a 15 parameter group that rather than 10 parameter group that kind of relates scattering amplitudes, loosely speaking. And so the first time you get something that is not symmetry protected is if you have six gluon scattering, because each gluon has three parameters, so you get 3n minus 15, and the first time 3n minus 15 is larger than zero is if n is equal to six. So the first time something interesting happens that's not kind of dominated just by the symmetries of the problem is for the hexagon. And so in the beginning, first 20 minutes or so, I will try to review the story. So for the hexagon, actually, it turns out it's all beautifully in shape, and there's a complete answer for this. And indeed, there's complete beautiful formulas that allow to compute high energy scattering from string theory. And of course, much of this has been developed here, or part of it, yeah. And so I'll try to stick that story to 20 minutes so that you don't also have some time to discuss something new. So this will be the simplest case. In some sense, it's sort of a very interesting threshold, because for the first time, you actually enter a regime which is not completely determined by the symmetries of the problem. So after those 20 minutes or so, I will then gear up to discuss what's known at a higher number of gluons. So then first of all, we have to, I mean, here we will get away with just understanding the high energy limit as a limit where S becomes very large in some sense. Now then we will have to learn a little bit what high energy limit actually means. So I'll teach you a little bit about the kinematics. There's much more room to play with. It's like coming from one variable to multivariable. So there's a lot of room to play with. I have to teach you a little bit how that works. And then I will go beyond the hexagon and tell you what's known. Mostly this is parameterizing the unknown, and then I'll tell you a little bit of what's actually known in this regime. Are there any questions? Oh, so this, you will see that comes up a little bigger. That's a kinematics. Somebody throwing a ball. Okay, so let's go to the hexagon, and as I said, should be done. Sorry, this is a little messy, but so what we'll start with is somehow to set the stage. I start with something that can be reached with just perturbative gauge theory, and I'm sure you have all heard that for the six gluon scattering in n equals four super Young mills, people computed. So there's some piece that contains all the IR divergences, which is called BDS, and then the remaining piece is sort of the so-called remainder function, which is now synonymous for us in terms of computing the amplitude. So this two-loop remainder function for two-loop has been actually computed by standard gauge theory techniques, and you've probably all seen this, heard that there's a 17-page answer when you just do it. And then there was this beautiful paper work of Goncharov and collaborators that managed to use some kind of fancy math, this symbol calculus, to kind of bring this down to a two-line formula. Okay. So anyway, so more or less by gauge theory techniques, Feynman graph computation, plus a little bit of fancy math, you get a formula for this n equals a two-loop scattering amplitude of six gluons. So in this case, it's actually a function of, so 3n minus 15 in this case is 3. So it's a function of three variables, and I'll call them u, w, and w star. You don't have to worry what they are. I will give you precise definitions for the experts a little later. And so it's a concrete formula that I didn't write down because you probably have seen it or you believe that it exists. And what you probably, if you have ever seen it, what you remember from that formula is that it contains a bunch of polylogs, okay? Now, polylogs are, of course, functions that have cuts, like a logarithm has cuts. So polylogs have cuts, so an amplitude has cuts. And when you continue this simple function that was found by these by Goncharov and collaborators in the complex plane, I mean, in complex U, W, and W star, you will hit eventually these cuts and pick up contributions. So the picture is sort of, it's a multi-valued function basically on the complex plane. So the high energy limit is now a limit where you send the center of mass energy roughly to infinity and make it very large compared to the transverse T variables, basically. That's the idea. But you can make S very large either by sending S to plus infinity or minus infinity, okay? And when you do, when you translate this, I mean, the Mandelstam variables S and T, I mean, these U, W, and W star are concrete cross ratios of these Mandelstam variables. You will see that what happens in the high energy limit when you send the absolute value of S to infinity, it reminds to sending U to one. But if you send it to minus infinity, you actually send U first around a circle around the origin before you send it to one, okay? So when you take this concrete formula that Goncharov et al. Wrote down, that was more or less obtained by a gauge theory computation, and you take the limit U to one, you get basically that that this remainder function actually should be zero here, sorry, is zero. The exponential is one. So there's no contribution. So you do the high energy limit of this remainder function, you get zero, okay? Now, now that's of course not very interesting to find zero. And that would even be consistent with the whole remainder function being zero. So if that was the whole story, then the high energy limit wouldn't really tell you anything. But it's not the whole story. So you have some freedom in this high energy limit, as I just told you. You can also go S to minus infinity. And that amounts to first taking U in the plane around the origin, and then taking the U to one limit. And in this process, actually this formula of Goncharov et al. Picks up a cut contribution, and the limit of that cut contribution is actually non-zero, okay? So you can do a very simple example of this type. So if I take Li2 here, of the argument one minus one over u prime is now u times e to the two pi I, okay? Then you know the Li2 has a cut when you go around the unit circle. And the cut contribution, like in the logarithm, would be 2 pi I. And for the dialogue, it's a log contribution. So you pick up this log contribution. So this is the continuation. And then you take the high energy limit. That is, you send u to 1. So Li2 of 0 is 0. So that vanishes. But this piece here is non-zero and gives a divergent contribution in the limit, okay? So that's a very simple example to see how this actually, how this works. And since this formula for two loop is actually built up from such pieces, that's really the mechanism by which it really works. So you can also do this for the full Goncharov, not just for this mock version of it, formula. And you will find basically this contribution. So this is a two-loop answer. It comes multiplied with a squared. That's the Young-Mills coupling. And then there's a piece that diverges with 1 minus u. And then one piece that is just a function of this w. Okay. And so quantum field theorists call this here the leading log contribution, because that's the leading power of log. So of log 1 minus u, it comes, so it's a to the power of 2, or lambda to the power, a to the power 2. And multiply it with ln 1 minus u. If you would go to higher orders in perturbation theory, you get higher powers of a, and the leading log contribution is always one power lower in log n 1 minus u. So so that's the leading log piece, and then, okay. So the remarkable thing is now that, so this is a two-loop computation, and of course you can try to push this higher, but that's of course very hard. But it turns out that Lipatov and collaborators over many years developed some technology to actually compute at least this sort of leading log pieces, okay? So this piece here, this function of W that appears here, and in fact, also the function of W that appears in front of the leading log or at three loops, four loops, five loops, can all be encoded in a very simple formula. And that formula has this form here. So, so this is now a formula for the exponential of the remainder function. Don't bother with this delta here. So it turns out that you can write it in this form, okay, where you have a sum over k, an integer, an integral over nu. These are quantum numbers of SL2. And the most interesting objects in here are actually this remainder function, are this phi and w. This is where all the coupling dependence sits, okay? So this is known as BFKL eigenvalue, and this is known as impact factor, okay? And so Bartels and collaborators, Lipatov, Sabiavera, they computed this in leading log and next to leading log approximation. So leading log I just produced, so that you see some concrete formula. So it's a concrete result that depends on A. When you plug that in here, you can expand this formula and evaluate all these leading log terms to any basically loop order that you want. So you will always find a to the power of the loop order times log 1 minus u to the power l minus 1. And the coefficient, the w dependence of the coefficient is completely encoded in this formula. With just these leading log pieces, okay, so in leading log approximation, this impact factor is just 1. Okay, so that's quite remarkable. This formula contains some all loop information, but only about the leading log, so this leading piece in this formula. So it actually turned out that this has a nice interpretation. This BFCAL eigenvalue is actually the eigenvalue of a little spin chain, of two-side spin chain, SL2 spin chain that you can compute, and that's the result. So people pushed this technology a little further and did Lex to leading log computation, so that would allow you to get the one order lower piece in the, so that would be a to the power of l log to the power of 1 minus u to the power l minus 2. And eventually, with some combination of the same kind of techniques, symbology and stuff like that, even expressions up to n next to leading log and next to leading log were obtained. Okay, so you can play this game and get some results. So now I'll go a little bit against history. So you can try to push that further, but eventually what happened is that last year, people here actually found a way of getting this BFKL eigenvalue and impact factor to all log order, okay? And so this is now a real sort of string result. What goes into that I just describe here how you compute this BFKL eigenvalue. I shouldn't have called this first variable u. This is a different u. This is just a dummy variable here. So what goes into this formula is really now string theory. This q here is essentially the charge density of the of a string that rotates in ADS, like a folded string that rotates in ADS. So that's an integrable system. So this string that rotates in ADS has infinitely many charges, conserved charges. The simplest one is the energy density, and then there's an infinite tower of conserved charges. You can package all that into a function, q of t, that contains all these charges of these rotating strings. And then there's an equation that's called the Beisert-Eden-Staudacher equation. That's a linear equation that you can explicitly write down that determines this function q of t, okay? That determines basically this charge density of this rotating string in ADS at any value of the coupling, okay? So this you can work out. I mean, the coefficients of this are just integrals over products of Bessel functions. So it's an explicit equation, and you can solve that both at weak and strong coupling to any order you want. You get this Q. Now, once you have this Q, so this Q is really something that comes from string theory, okay? That really is a quantity that encodes the data of a rotating string. Once you have this Q, you plug it into these formulas, and you compute, so k is again an integer. So remember, this w was a function of nu, of a continuous variable nu, and an integer k. So what you do is you basically compute this w of u and k and nu of u and k, and then you have to solve this second equation basically for u, plug it into the first equation, and that way you get the BFKL eigenvalue, okay? So more or less, and you can play this game, and in fact, it's not so difficult, and you can easily reproduce all these gauge theory results more or less by hand, and of course go to much much higher orders. Okay, so this is a very remarkable step, and of course that's why I said some of this the hexagon story is a story that is. Where the psi energy limit is understood as well as you can wish for. Now, what the authors also observed was that when you go to strong coupling, then these BFKL eigenvalues, which are functions of nu and k, they degenerate. So they just all go to the same limiting number, w of infinity, okay? So there's the dependence on nu and k drops out. And so when you go back to this formula, you see that basically, so this thing here will no longer have a dependence on u and k, so this piece can be taken out of the integral and you get a relatively simple result. Now that result, in fact, was known before this interpolation, and you can get that by directly analyzing string theory at strong coupling, and that's also sort of a nice story. So again, let me try to kind of explain that with without any technicalities. So if you want to access sort of the strongly coupled regime for scattering in n equals 4 super Young mills, you know you have to well, you have to do string theory in ADS space or supergravity in ADS space. And the problem of scattering in Young-Mills theory, as explained by Alde and Maltathena many years ago, is sort of mapped to a Wilson loop problem, where you basically, you again look at this polygon, and then you look at the minimal area surface that ends on this polygon, and the area of this thing is essentially the scattering amplitude, okay? Now this is a geometric problem, so which is in fact in this form not so easy to address, at least if you have a large number, more than 4 or 5 corners in your polygon. But then there was a beautiful reformulation of this problem as a one-dimensional quantum system. And in a way, it's sort of the blueprint of a quantum computer that does solve this minimal area problem. So what Pedro and others, and Davide, and 3 others sort of described, and as a result of a mathematical theorem, is basically a one-dimensional quantum system which is designed, so it has a certain number of fundamental excitations in it, which have masses and chemical potentials. These are parameters of your system. And it has a one-to-one, I mean, it has scattering, I mean, interactions, these things. And this interaction is integrable, so you just have to fix the 2x2 scattering matrix, and then you have completely fixed the interaction. And when you have such a system, you dial basically the masses and chemical potentials, and then you let your system evolve. I mean, of course, even the vacuum will be sort of a complicated state and will have certain energy. And so you let the system evolve and eventually read off the vacuum energy of the system, and that's then giving this remainder function, okay? So, and as you vary sort of the parameters of your system, and for each choice of parameters, again, I mean, this is a complicated system, as any quantum system, right? There are all these kind of fluctuations happening all the time. And whenever you change the parameters of the system, the densities of all these individual excitations will readjust. And then eventually you can compute from these densities the energy. And that is then so with this description of the energy or the remainder function or the scattering amplitude, we're wondering, I mean, where do the cut contributions come from? Okay, so we learned that an amplitude usually has these cut contributions. It's not an analytic functions of the variables, but it has cuts. So what do the cuts correspond to in this one-dimensional quantum system? Okay, and so there was actually some, so now we should understand the following. So I didn't really describe that in detail, but the parameters that you have in this one-dimensional quantum systems are these masses and chemical potentials of the particles. The parameters that you have in the scattering process are the kinematic variables. And of course, there's a map between the two. So changing the masses and chemical potentials in this one-dimensional quantum system corresponds to changing the kinematic variables, I mean, the kinematics of your process, okay? So we explore sort of the cuts we find by analytically continuing the kinematic variables. So that would correspond in the one-dimensional quantum system to just changing the masses and chemical potentials along certain curves in the complex plane, let's say. And people in statistical physics had actually played with such problems in integrable one-dimensional quantum systems, and they looked at what happens when you continue parameters like masses parameters in the complex plane, and they saw something interesting. You can have some kind of hysteresis effect, so you can actually play with parameters and come back to original values. But what happened is, in the process, you actually created some excitations in your system. Okay. And so suddenly you don't have the vacuum, you come back, you don't have the vacuum state anymore, but you have created certain excitations, okay? So so we realized that basically this is what happens, and you can do that quite explicitly. You can take, like for instance, for the hexagon, you can take this one-dimensional quantum system, continue the kinematic variables along the parameters that you need to continue to see some cut contributions, and you will indeed see that these equations that describe these densities of particles in this one-dimensional quantum system along these same curves will indeed have excitations produced, okay? So So then the next question was, what is the high energy limit? What does that correspond to? And again, that was a very beautiful story. So the, in the high energy limit, if you take it without any continuation, you actually find that the remainder function is zero. So the BDS answer is kind of high energy exact. And so the answer is zero. And so now you can wonder what limit do you have to take in this one-dimensional quantum system in order to get a zero energy. And of course, you see, normally, of course, the vacuum is a super complicated thing. Something is created and annihilated all the time. In order to kind of turn that off, you just send the masses of the individual particles to infinity, right? So then you kind of suppress all these fluctuations, and you get zero. And so indeed, if you do that in a smart way, one has to, but in six hexagon, that's more, that's just that. It turns out that sort of this high energy limit is really just a large mass limit or infrared limit of this one-dimensional quantum system, okay? And that limit, you turn off these fluctuations. So if you now have done a continuation first, you've picked up these excitation energies, and now you take the large mass limit. Again, you suppress all the fluctuations in your quantum system, and what you get is the energy is just sort of the sum of the energies of the bare particles. So also these excitation energies are much easier to compute in that limit, okay? So in fact, there's just a beta ansatz type equation. So this complicated system of integral equations, coupled integral equations that determine all these particle densities and energies sort of in the full system. In this high energy limit, they kind of simplify, the quantum fluctuations are turned off, and you just get contributions from bare particles, which are relatively easy to compute. And so this is something that actually started us off. So we computed that a few years ago using this picture concretely for this hexagon scattering. And we found indeed that there was essentially two excitations created, you could compute their energies and convert that into a formula for the scattering amplitude. And you got this simple formula here for the scattering amplitude with an exponent here, which is W infinity, which we computed at the time. In fact, I should say at the time we made a sign mistake, but we later corrected that. And after this correction, that was a kind of trivial sign mistake, it actually is the same value that was found then later as a result of this interpolation. So that beautifully connects to that story, okay? So indeed, it all fits together very nicely. So there is a recoupling studies, which is more or less based on standard field theory results that kind of set you off sort of at recoupling. Then there's this strong coupling system, which is basically an interesting physics of this one-dimensional quantum system, which simplifies also in the high energy limit, has a lot of integrability built in, of course. And then for the hexagon, there's this beautiful interpolation that interpolates very nicely between these weak coupling formulas and the strong coupling physics of this one-dimensional quantum system. Again, what this one-dimensional quantum system computes is basically the answer of a geometric problem, but it's kind of easier to work with in this reformulation as a one-dimensional quantum system. Okay, good. So this brings me to the end of the first part. So for those of you who haven't really followed this story in detail, maybe this is the most sort of most interesting message here is that somehow this high energy limit for this hexagon scattering is completely under control. And again, this is sort of bringing string theory to the regime where it traditionally failed. I mean, it's exactly at high energy scattering, and now basically. The full answer is again of this form, and there's a concrete way to compute this input, this coupling dependent input in this formula, okay, to any log order that you want. So that's quite remarkable. Okay, is there any questions? Yeah. Yeah, so you change basically how to say that the position, I mean, of initially they're all space-like separated, and you kind of continue into areas where where there you have time-like separation. Yes. Good. Any other question? Okay. So now, again, so if you're not working on scattering amplitudes, probably now sort of it gets more technical. Of course, after this huge success with six gluon scattering, the question is, can one proceed to higher number of gluons? Now, again, the full interpolation is possible for six gluons, so what happens to high number of gluons? So in this case, the kinematics, of course, becomes much richer because you have more degrees of freedom. Somehow, in the previous case, we had only one of these U variables that in the large high energy limit was going to one, and you had this WW star that parameterized the answer. What happens, of course, if you have more gluons, then you will have more of these variables, and you have to kind of come to terms with that. So in this kind of kinematics part, and I hope now you can see the picture, I'll teach you a little bit about how you parameterize actually high energy scattering in the case of higher number of gluons. So let's start with this picture. So we'll look at 2 to the n minus 2 high energy limit. So we have two incoming particles with a large center of mass energy S. And then we have, these two particles coming out plus a bunch of lower momentum or lower energy objects. And so what you do when you parameterize such a scattering process is, of course, you kind of can look at all the sub-energies of all these subsystems. So you have the energy carried away by this pair and this pair and this pair and this pair, and then the energy carried away by these three, and so on and so forth. Okay, so there's a bunch of these what I call to S-like variables, and then there's these energy transfer T's in this picture. So there's a total number here of n squared minus 3n times 1/2 Mandelstam invariants. And of course, they're not all independent. There's Gram relations between them. So in the end, of course, the number of Mandelstam invariants is 3n minus 10. It's linear in the number of. So it turns out that you can put them into a matrix. So in this matrix, I'll show you in a moment, that's very natural. In this matrix, so we have put the T-like variables here, and then the S-like variables that were the energies of pairs of particles, outgoing particles here, then triples, quadruples, and that's the total energy here. Okay, I put that in this matrix. And so this matrix is actually very natural because, as you probably know, there's a way for n equals 4 to parameterize, in some sense we've used that before, the momenta of the gluons in terms of these dual variables xi, which are sort of the cusp positions of these polygons. And then these xij are basically xi minus xj squared. So the length of the difference of xij. And so when you use that, you see what this matrix is actually just the matrix of these lengths between the different cusps arranged in the matrix, okay? And so up here in this first row are all the things that stay small in the multi-regi limit, and here these things become large in a particular way. Now, we know that scattering in n equals 4 is not parameterized by Mandelstam invariants, but by cross ratios. And so the cross ratios are somehow attached to tiles in this matrix. So you can build these kind of small tiles. So when I have such a tile here with four objects, I build one cross ratio out of that, which I call uij. And so basically, you have these small tiles here. There's, again, a square number of them because it's a surface, but there's only a linear number, 3n minus 5, independent ones. So all others are again, determined by Gram relations. So I have three colors here. So you can build these cross ratios along here in the top row. And then the ones here, which actually this thing means that it's actually ending on that side. So these are cross ratios, and then the red ones run along the diagonal. And then everything inside this triangle I call yellow. So our parameterization usually is to take the green ones, say everything on the boundary. That's, of course, linear. So the green ones and the red ones, and then the yellow ones are kind of expressible through ground relations from the other ones, okay? So so the green and the red ones together make 3n-5. So these are independent cross ratios, and all the yellow ones are kind of dependent through ground relations. So good. So now what happens to these cross ratios in the multi-regi limit? So as I just told you before, in multi-regi kinematics, all these things up here, they stay small. And then these things here become large. And they become large faster and faster depending on how high are they along this diagonal, basically. So the ones are down here, these were the single, the S1, S2, S3, they become large. But the next one, which sort of span over three particles, they become infinite larger, faster, and so on and so forth. So when you do multi-regi kinematics, you basically it turns out that these small guys, the ones that are sitting here along the boundary that were green before, they go to zero. The large ones, the red ones, go to one, such that the ratio, these two ratios here, they stay finite. And so you keep that that ratio fixed in the limit, and that's where you introduce this W parameters. Okay, so now you have a way again to introduce those. So the limit is taken such that these U1 sigmas, the ones that correspond somehow to this red tiles, they go to one, and the others, the green ones, to zero, and this gives the parameter parameterized basically the neighborhood of this multi-regi kinematics. So this corresponds to what I said before, just this naive U to one limit. Now you have a number of like n-5 U variables that can go to one, and you can all send them to one independently. Okay, so you have more variables. But now it's a question about, so at 6 point, we had to also do an analytic continuation, okay? So so what can you do in terms of analytic continuation? Now it turns out that you have much richer kind of class of regions. So what you can do is you can take all these the energies of these particles here and continue into regions where these have the opposite sign, okay? And I'll label the regions by rho. Rho keeps track of the signs of the energies of these particles that come out here. And so for instance, this would be plus, 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 but then I can also go to a region where the energy variables of this particle here, which is number 3 and number 5, 3 and 5, go to minus, this one stays plus, and so on and so forth. So then the cross ratios, of course, were function of the Mandelstam invariants. Of course, this basically means that Mandelstam invariants will kind of change their signs, and you can work out how they do that because you know how the Mandelstam invariants are related to these energies, right? So you work out what happens to the Mandelstam. So the Mandelstam S variables in this regime are all positive, and in this regime, some of them become negative. You can easily work that out. In fact, there's a mistake down here. And that should be smaller. And then, of course, the cross ratios, again, were functions of the Mandelstam invariants. You can work out what happens to the Mandelstam invariants, and you'll see that, I mean, in this case, for instance, the small ones are positive. In this case, they become negative. So somehow you do a continuation in these cross ratios. So these are the regions. So there's actually now more regions. So we have 2 to the n minus 4 regions, okay? Before n was 6. In fact, it should probably be 2 to the n minus. Yeah, so no, it's 2 to the n minus 4 regions. 3 of them, in fact, or n minus 3 of them are more or less trivial. So you get basically one non-trivial interesting region for hexagon case, but then you get with any time you add one gluon, you get a factor of 2 more interesting regions, okay? So you have much more limits to perform. And you can now perform continuations between these different regions. And that means, again, that some of these cross ratios will start to wind around zero, okay? And so these cross ratios uij, which correspond to these things here, including the yellow tiles, they will just have winding given by this formula. So in terms of these signs that describe the region, you can just compute how each of these cross ratios will actually rotate, okay? So that's the formula that gives you this. So for instance, if you send all these things to minus in an n gluon scattering process, then only the very largest cross ratio will acquire a phase. Only the one in the hexagon, heptagon case, only this one will acquire a phase. All others will not rotate. So there's only a single cross ratio in that case that will acquire a phase. And so for the hexagon case, there was only one. So that one, that's a phase, one U variable. In the other case, it's a little more complicated. Okay, good. So this is the story about kinematics. So sorry, that was a bit technical. But I think you should have gotten the picture. So multi or high energy limit for more than six gluons, of course, has more freedom. You have many more regions to go into, multi-regi region or Mandelstam regions to explore, in which you can get interesting new results. And they're all related by some continuation along curves, which are in principle well understood. So they're just more or less defined by winding number, and the winding is well understood. So you can give me any region that you like, and we can see what happens to all these cross ratios when you continue into that region. So that's all well under control, and so there's nothing happening here that is. I mean, again, this is just kinematics. Okay, so I just had to boost it up from the single variable case in some sense to the multivariable case. Okay, any questions on this? So now let's go beyond the hexagon, okay, and see what's known here. So I'll start again with the weak coupling story. And so in the weak coupling story, the first important thing is that there are again, I mean, of course, there are cuts and there are cut contributions, and these cut contributions can be written in a form that is very similar to what we saw for the hexagon. You remember I gave you this formula. So I showed you this formula here for this for the cut contribution in the hexagon case, which had this impact factor here and this piece that comes from contains the BFKL eigenvalue. And the generalization of that formula can actually be used for higher number of gluons to compute cut contributions. Sorry for that. Okay, so. It turns out the cut contributions are actually, again, parameterized by a multiple of integers, which you should maybe think of in terms of these pictures. So you start with integer one here, and then you can go up and down in steps of one or zero. Okay, so that's parameterizes cut contributions. And so the piece is essentially as before. So you have these pieces here. I wrote them slightly differently. This would be a like the pieces that contain the BFKL eigenvalues, they are attached to these areas in between the two black dots, okay? And then you have phis, which are attached to these black dots. So you make any kind of picture that you like. Chalk. Okay, so if you have, for instance, in let's say octagon process. Or, so you could come up with a picture like this. So here, the number of these wavy lines grows at most one. It can also go down. Of course, another cut contribution would be this. Well, there's also cut contribution like that. And so for each piece here, you basically get a piece that involves a BFKL eigenvalue that looks like the one in the hexagon case, except that the exponent eventually changes. So the exponent depends on how many of these wavy lines you have here, okay? So in the case that we had before, we had basically corresponds to two wavy lines. So we had, that's the W was what I would call now W2. And so you have a number of different types of these BFKL eigenvalues, which are now parameterized by an integer. So that's the piece here. And then you have these things attached to the blobs, and particle physicists call them impact factors if the number of wavy lines changes, and production vertices if the number of wavy lines stays fixed, okay? So the claim is that you can always parameterize the cut contributions in this way. And in principle, so again, in the hexagon case, there was only one such picture. Okay, so there was this piece here that involved the BFKL eigenvalue, and then here the pieces that come from the impact factors. And I told you that in that case, both things were computed first in leading log and next to leading log are now known to all orders. So so here, people went ahead and started to look into these contributions. So the one thing that is actually known is that these eigenvalues, Wp, again, Wp now corresponds to having a p of these wavy lines. So W2 would be the BFKL eigenvalue that we saw in the hexagon case. To leading log approximation, it's again the eigenvalue of a well-known spin chain. It's a Heisenberg spin chain with now p spins. And the eigenvalue can be computed, and actually is basically just the sum of eigenvalues of the two-side spin chain. Okay, but this is only a leading log result. So to leading log, these exponents are known that appear in these pieces here. So these corresponding BFKL eigenvalues. The Hamiltonian is also known in next to leading log approximation. Now for the other building blocks, so the impact factors, again in the hexagon case, this guy appeared already. So that was also computed in leading log, next to leading log, and as I told you, is now known to all loop order, okay? And first time such a production vertex appears is in the heptagon case when you have seven gluons, and that would correspond, you see, when you have seven gluons, then basically the only thing you can only go up and down by one, so you can go up by one. And so the most interesting cut contribution is basically this. You can never get to three wavy lines because you can only change by one. So you will only have in the heptagon case, you will only have the omega 2, the thing that is known explicitly to all log order. You have the impact factors, which are also known to all loop order or log order, and then you have this production vertex, which is known to leading log approximation. Okay, so from this you can, in principle, play now the same game that I talked about before. You can plug this information in, and at least to leading log, you can now find contributions from these formulas to any loop order. Okay, but only to leading log because the production vertex isn't known beyond leading log. Now there's one extra complication in this story: is that this is cut contributions, but this is not trivially associated with the Mandelstam regions. So the Mandelstam region are parameterized by rho, this choice of signs of the energies of the outgoing particles. The cut contributions are parameterized by p, and the two are not so trivially related. It's not like one to one. So in the hexagon case, this rho minus minus, where you take both these have negative energy, receives contribution only from this cut. Okay, there's just no other cut anyway. For the heptagon case, the minus 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 contribution, for instance, receives energy contributions only from this cut, which is the one that I just described, where in order to compute things, you just have to know the impact factors. You have all log results, production vertex, you have one leading log result, and the omega 2 eigenvalue. But for other regions, you can have actually superposition. Several cuts can contribute. Okay, and in principle, you can explore that using less locality, just kind of getting constraints from locality and try to pick up the cut contribution. Another way of doing that is actually you can use the symbol. In fact, the symbol of this two-loop remainder is known for any number of gluons. Okay, that was computed by Simon. Years ago, and you can from there you can compute the symbol of the remainder function in any of these Mandelstam regions in the multi-regi limit. Okay, and that of course will know about all the cut contributions that contribute. So, for instance, when you do this for the pentagon case, and you go to the minus plus minus Mandelstam region, so the two that would correspond to the one that is like that. Then it turns out, so this is a Mandelstam region, it turns out that when you compute the symbol of the remainder function in that region of multi-regular kinematics, it's actually built up from the symbols of the remainder function are associated with these Mandelstam regions. And these are actually associated with unit cut contributions. So this is actually a combination of cut contributions. Okay, so it's not a fundamental cut contribution. So this in principle can be, again, so I told you at this point, I would more or less just parameterize the unknown. So this is now what I've achieved. So the claim is that in the high energy multi-gluon scattering, the cut contributions can be parameterized in this form. So the unknown in here are these things involving the BFKL eigenvalue. Only the omega 2 is known to all log order. All the others are only known to leading log. And the impact factors and production vertices, which mostly are only known to leading, mostly are not known, in fact, and some of them are known to leading order. So this is basically parameterizing, okay? So this is just, in order to solve the problem of high energy scattering, you have to just give formulas for all these quantities, okay? And this will compute the cut contributions for you, and then you can have to put them together in order to get really the contributions in the various Mandelstam regions. So let me briefly talk about what's known as strong coupling. So at strong coupling, you can play the same games that I talked about before with this one-dimensional quantum system, and you can play that in particular for instance, seven gluons. And so then you have a new system. It is richer than the one for six gluons. It has three extra fundamental objects in it. Again, 2-to-2 scattering. Scattering matrices are known. You have more masses and chemical potentials to play with. And in particular, you can look at, let's say, at this regime here. So there's a particular Mandelstam region, which is the minus, minus, minus one. I told you that you reach that by taking this the one yellow triangle, one yellow tile, and rotate that along the origin. You can play that, implement that in this one-dimensional quantum system, and you will see again there's something happening. Excitations are being produced, and in the end, when the dust settles, you see that there's four excitations produced, and when you switch off, sort of go to the large mass limit, you just compute the energy contributions from these bare excitations. You actually find that the remainder function is just given as a sum of two contributions, one involving the first set of three variables, U1, W1, W1 star, the second one, U2, W2, W2 star. And this is actually, this answer is, it's sort of, the way it comes out of this quantum system is quite, it's not so obvious. It doesn't look like two copies of the hexagon result, but it is basically just the sum of these results. But it's beautifully consistent with this formula that I showed you, because in this case, there is just a single cut contribution that's coming from this cut. And you see the eigenvalues here are the only eigenvalues that appear in that case are the ones, the W2s, which is known to all log order. And from the all log result, we know that these become constant independent of the nu and k. And so when you plug that into this formula, then you'll see that you can take out these two factors that have the dependence on u and w in them, and you get precisely this result. So it's very nicely consistent, this strong coupling result, with this parameterization of the cut contribution through the formula I showed you. Okay, so so that brings me to the end. So there's of course a bunch of questions one can address in order to progress. In fact, I didn't talk here about the other Mandelstam regions. So for a heptagon case, there's four of them. Three of them have very nice results. The fourth of them, which is the one that for which several cuts contribute, actually there's it's not clear how to get a sort of geometric prediction from that. As I told you, the only piece that's missing for seven gluon is this production vertex. It would be very interesting to find that, of course, to all loop order, all log order. For n equal 8, there's something for the first time. There's, as I showed in this picture, there's a first time sort of three of these lines. So that's the first time when you see a new eigenvalue. And of course, it would be interesting to compute that eigenvalue. In fact, the value at infinite coupling, that's more or less doable with the techniques I talked about, but it has not been computed. So that's, of course, more technical things to make progress in this. For those of you who have kind of a little higher altitude to look at these things, I hope at least convinced you that this full and very explicit solution, in fact, an easy to use solution of this high energy scattering problem in planar n equals 4 Zhiyang Mills is actually a totally realistic goal. And in fact, it's really easy to use. I mean, when you kind of try to reproduce results, gauge theory results, using these formulas that I showed you of the work of Basso et al, it's really not too difficult. I mean, it's much, much simpler. So I think that's sort of the main message, that this high energy regime in n equals 4 Zhiyang Mills, and of course, in many ways you've heard this message here, is actually particularly a nice region for precision computation. It's precisely sort of the regime where, of course, string theory in the 70s failed. So somehow that's kind of quite nice to see that it's back there and really solves the problem and gets over this trauma of early string theory. Okay, thank you. So we know the continuation. We know which, of course, from the formula, which quasi ratios two rotations, and we kind of insert that into the TBA, and then look at what happens with excitations. And in fact, turns out there's no excitation produced. But it certainly doesn't. If it's it should receive cut contribution from both the long cuts and the short cuts, and so it should be sort of a superposition of these pieces. So it's not clear to me how to resolve that issue. So far, it works beautifully for all the cases that have single cut contributions. I mean, there's Mandelstam regions, the ones where you have adjacent signs flipped, which have a single cut contribution. For those, the geometric or the strong coupling thing works well. For the ones that have superpositions, I don't quite know what to do. So this is something that maybe you have some insight. So right now, if you just play this game in this one-dimensional quantum system, there's just no excitation produced, and you would conclude that this thing is zero, but that's certainly not the case. Okay.
And what's the meaning of the beta equation that finite coupling?
No, I mean, so the beta ansatz equation that.
Yeah,
I mean,
these are. Limit and you get this beta equation. Right?
Yes, but these are not infinite. I mean, this is an infinite coupling, right? I mean, this is a geometric problem translated into a quantum language, as you know. Yeah.
Finite coupling?
I don't know. I mean, you would probably know better than me that what the counterpart looks like. So I don't know the answer to that.
So you've mostly been talking about the MHV case.
How much
is known for the NMHV at 7.0?
Oh, MHV. Okay, I would have to check. I don't recall that out of my head. I mean, pretty much the things that I've played with here can also be done for NMHV, but I'm not up to date on the status of these things. I can remind myself. So if you want, yeah, we can talk about it after.
Is there any other question? If not, let's thank Volker again.